This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer James Atlas. After having written biographies of the novelist Saul Bellow and the poet Delmore Schwartz, after having edited the biographies in the Penguin Live series, then starting a new series of books, Eminent Lives, Atlas has written a memoir about being middle-aged. He writes, "The greatest challenge of middle age is to accept one's limitations. It's not easy." The table of contents will give you a sense of what he talks about in the book: time, home, money, failure, shrinks, the body, books, God, 25th anniversary, death. The book opens with something many people face in middle age, the death of parents. The first chapter begins with the dreaded phone call, "Dad's in the hospital." His parents had been living in an assisted living facility when his father was diagnosed with a brain abscess, which was followed by heart problems. James Atlas was 52, his father was 87. After a period of hospitalization, Atlas's father was moved to a floor devoted to nursing care at his assisted living facility. This reading takes place in his father's room just after he died. Atlas is talking with his father's nurse.
"She gave me the name of a local funeral home. I was uncomfortable making the call while the row of patients, residents, inmates, sat in their wheelchairs silently observing me, drooling, their heads lolling to the side, their arms crossed in their laps. I couldn't make this call in front of them. I told the nurse about my qualms, and she led me to a phone in her office. When I was done making the arrangements, I went back to his room. He lay there, no longer he, but a corpse now. The departure of my father's life from his body was at once a great mystery and the most ordinary thing in the world. I had never been in the presence of a dead body before. I marveled at the radical fact of absence, the finality of it all. Not a word, no directive, no sign would ever issue from him again. I lounged in a chair, my leg over the arm, at ease. Then my sister-in-law came in with my mother. She stood over him and tried to take it in. 'I'm not ready to let you go, Bunny,' she said, talking to him in the same intimate, bantering voice I'd been hearing all summer. 'We had a good time, didn't we, darling? We laughed and laughed and had a good time. But I didn't want you to go yet. I didn't want you to go.' She kissed his head and turned to me, a confused look on her face. 'How did I let him get away?' she said. She went over to the window and looked out at the green lawn, the green shrubs visible at eye level through the basement window. 'Dear, I know this sounds strange,' she said in a half whisper, 'but I feel like he's still breathing.' On the bureau was a can of Gillette shaving cream that I'd bought the day before at Walgreens. I was planning to give him a shave, but it was too late for that now. I would take it home and use it myself."
That's James Atlas reading from his new memoir, My Life in the Middle Ages. Your book is about getting older and about your own mortality, and of course it starts with the death of your father. Writers are usually very self-conscious people who are always standing back and observing everything, even standing back and observing themselves. When your father died, did you feel what you expected to feel or what you thought you ought to feel?
No, it was a very liberating experience, because I felt that his death, I know this sounds strange, but that it worked out right, that I spent a few months with him, that we said our goodbyes. It felt like a passage that had taken its course and been done right.
You say that for your father, one of the most important aspects of parenting was to make the child feel no obligation whatever to the parents, and that your father's parents had oppressed and crowded him, but he would set his children free whether they wanted to be free or not. What obligations did you feel to your parents as they got older and had more trouble taking care of themselves?
It's a very complicated thing, because one does feel this obligation, and it's part of one's own life. You have to take care of them. You have to be sure that they have enough money, that they're in the adequate place for themselves, that they're not alone, that they're not neglected. And yet at the same time, if I may say so, there's this resentment. It's as if you want to lead your own life and get on with it. And then I recall that they felt that way about their own parents. I had an argument with my mother the other day and made her burst into tears. And then she said to me a few days later, she said, I felt so bad because it reminded me of the way I used to yell at my own mother. So instead of getting angry at me, she felt guilty and recalled the entire experience of what she had gone through. And now I feel I'm sure it's the experience that my children will go through with me.
My guest is James Atlas, and he's written a new memoir, which is called My Life in the Middle Ages. Let's talk a little bit about how you're dealing with being in what you describe as late middle age, or approaching late middle age. How does being in your 50s compare to how it looked to you when you were a young man?
Well, it's very strange. As I said to my son this morning when I explained that I really liked cross-country skiing, even though it was boring to him, I said, look, I'm 55. And when I said it, I thought, isn't that strange? And yet, there's a kind of elasticity now to middle age and late middle age. People say to me when they read my book, well, what's old age? And if they're 60, I said, well, you're in late middle age. And if they're 70, I say, well, you're in rather late middle age. And no one is old anymore. It's wonderful. We've banished old age. So don't worry about it.
But how does it feel to be in your 50s compared to how it looked to you when you were young?
It feels, in a way, like an act of completion. When you're young, I was so confused and so uncertain of my identity and my future. And now I feel a certain confidence that I never had before, a certain at-homeness, a certain comfort in the world. And even though I have much ahead of me, I hope, I've made my peace with certain things. And I find that very reassuring. On the one hand, you feel the imminent approach of mortality. On the other hand, you look back and can judge and assess what you've accomplished. And even if it's not quite what you aspire to accomplish, it's enough. And so there's this feeling of serenity that I certainly didn't have when I was young.
What are some of the things you've made your peace with?
Oh, I've made my peace with a lot of things. I've had and hope to continue to have a good writing career, but I didn't turn out to be a famous novelist, and that's okay. I'm lucky I got to make a living as a writer. And barring some surprise, I'm not going to be rich, and that's okay, except for my alarming credit card bills. And I am not going to grow anymore. I'm going to remain just under 5'6", and that's the end of that. So it's...
I have no words for encouragement on that one.
So I gather from what I know of you. But that's okay, too, right, Terry?
Right, right.
We're still okay.
You write a little bit about your body and how it's changing, and you say, I'm intermittently aware of my body, conscious that it's beginning to break down. Mom is conscious of her body all the time. Nothing will relieve her dizziness. The doctors have tried everything. I know what you mean when you say, I'm aware of my body. If, you know, any kind of you have a symptom, your body's kind of speaking to you, and you'd prefer... it'd be quiet.
Yes, I really don't want to hear about it.
Right.
And Anna, my wife, and I made this vow never to talk about our ailments. I have friends who I have friends who are beginning to talk about their arthritis and their digestive issues. And I think this is just incredible. I'll never do this. And yet, sometimes when I feel mildly arthritic myself, I have to contain myself from talking about what seems to me an incredibly interesting issue, namely that I have arthritis, which I don't actually have. It's impending. I'm preparing for arthritis. I'm actually in great shape.
You've published a lot of biographies. You've written two biographies, Delmore Schwartz and Saul Bellow. In 1996, you wrote a really interesting and pretty now famous piece on the memoir, on the growing popularity of the memoir as a form. And one of the questions you addressed in the piece is, why have so many memoirs focused on dysfunction? And you talked about how Joyce Carol Oates had come up with the word pathography to describe biographies that dwell on the sordid excess of their subjects. And you came up with the term autopathography.
I did? Oh, that's not bad.
Wasn't that yours? Yeah, I assume
yes,
that was yours.
Yes, I'll claim it. Yeah,
it's a great term, and you came up with that for memoirs that dwell on the sordid excesses of oneself.
Right. Well, so you could all write that book.
Yeah. So why do you think that, what does it say to you that so many memoirs over the years have focused on dysfunction?
I really hope mine doesn't, but there's a kind of prurience, I think, to it. There's a sense of... well, perhaps there, but for the grace of God, if you're lucky, or there's the sense of association with the subject. You know, this biography, this autobiography by Augustine Burroughs that's been on the bestseller list forever, Running with Scissors, I think that's an incredible book because it shows that you can survive. And when I talk about a survivor's tale, I'm being slightly ironic. But when you read some of these books, especially the good ones, you just marvel at the fact that these people did survive. You really want to know the truth about other people's lives. And I happen to feel that fiction doesn't do that now, that it's really the realm of nonfiction that gives you this information. It gives you this sense that of identification and the sense that other people suffer the way you do or suffer more than you do.
Do you think, too, that the whole sense of what is private and what shouldn't be discussed has changed? So things that you couldn't possibly address before, having to do with maybe sexual dysfunction or even things like lying, are kind of fair game for discussion in print. And so, like, they were pioneers who first kind of settled that territory, and then, like, everybody else moved in, too.
Yeah, they certainly did. There were the pioneers, and I hope I haven't followed them. I hope I've stayed on the Eastern Seaboard, because I didn't want to write a book that was that kind of revelation. I know this is virtually impossible, but I wanted to write the truth and at the same time maintain my privacy. My children read an earlier chapter of my book that I threw out because my daughter, who's very keen about literature, said, "Dad, this didn't really happen this way. You're making this up." And I decided that I didn't want to write it that way. I think you can write directly. I think you can write honestly. I think you can write the truth without this kind of excessive self-revelation. And it's hard to do. It's a very fine line. But I'm not really interested in parading my neuroses about. Even in the chapter of my book called Shrinks, which goes on and on, I don't really say what the problems are that I was talking about.
How did you decide where to draw the line about what you wanted to talk about in your memoir and the revelations that were really too personal to put in?
Oh, it's hard to talk about because I didn't put them in. But right. I think there are lots of private issues. I don't know. When I start writing and I don't feel comfortable and I don't feel at ease with the material, that's when I know I've gone over the line. And it's something that you learn after a while as a writer. You have to find your so-called comfort zone, and for some people that's just saying it all and they have a nothing to lose attitude about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer, editor, publisher James Atlas. His new book is called My Life in the Middle Ages, and it's about growing middle-aged. You write a little bit about being in therapy in your memoir, and you know you had a lot of talk therapy, Freudian therapy. Without getting into what you were in therapy for, what your therapy sessions were like, I'm wondering if they were useful for you as a literary critic. Because so much of therapy is trying to get to the bottom of character, which is part of the work of a writer or a literary critic. Biographer.
Yeah, I think what happens in therapy is that you come up with what they call a narrative. You tell yourself a story about why you ended up the way you are, and what were the formative influences and events that created the self you're now carrying around with you. And then it turns out to be just a story. And as I got older, I began to realize that this narrative was fiction in a way, useful fiction, but I learned how to tell a story, even if it wasn't the way things really were, and I became more and more interested in telling a story of the way things were, and that's how I ended up writing this book.
And what was the difference between the story that you learned to tell about yourself through therapy and the story that you tell in your memoir?
The first one wasn't true, and the second one is true. But it was very entertaining to make up these stories. No, actually, I'm rather quite militantly anti-therapy. And I think that we do create these stories, and they become fictions. They become myths, but we hide behind them.
So, you said you distrust therapy. Did you find, like, the narrative you came up with in therapy was too explanatory, too about cause and effect? Someone did this to me, therefore I did that. This happened to me in school, therefore I did this. Was that the problem?
Yeah, well, you know, I feel that I now have changed my mind entirely, and I really feel that biology is destiny, and that when you look at anyone, including yourself, you can diagnose them. You can see whether they have depression or whether they have mood volatility, and these are just inherited traits. I really don't believe in the narrative any longer. I believe that we are the way we are because it's our biological fate. That's what I really feel. There's very little narrative. Maybe certain things happen, certain traumas that shaped you, but you really are who you are.
So this might be too personal, but do you take any psychopharmaceutical drugs? Because, I mean, you believe in, like, biology, the biology of mood. Do you tamper with the mood?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to give you my whole pharmacological history, but right. Since it's in the book, obviously, like millions of others, I have dabbled in psychopharm and found it very helpful. And I don't think it's a mechanical issue. Take three of these and four of those and you'll be fine. But I do think that there are profound transformations that occur. I'm sure that you're familiar with Peter Kramer's book, Listening to Prozac. That book is really my Bible now because it tells you what I've just said. It is a book that's not deterministic entirely, but that really explains the profound transformations of character that occur when we take certain drugs.
One more thing. You are planning to write a history of biography as a form. And so you're reading a lot of, like, ancient biographies as well as contemporary ones. And at the same time, you're working on a memoir that would be a follow-up to the memoir about middle age that you just published. So do you think that all these, like, ancient biographies that you're reading will affect at all your second memoir?
I feel it's such an interesting experience to read these books and follow the development of the self from ancient biography through medieval lives of the saints, and then to the gradual emergence of identity as we know it. And when I read Dr. Johnson's Lives of the Poets, or a book I was reading the other day by Daniel Defoe, a biography of a famous London criminal of the 18th century, I find that I now can understand myself as part of a continuum. It gives me a certain humility that my work simply reflects the voice of my time and the way we define ourselves, the way we define the self. So in a way, it sort of gets me off the hook, if you see what I mean, that I can write the way I want to write, and it will fall into this history of biography.
You mean that you don't have to worry about, you know, it being lasting or permanent, or, you know, that you could just write in your voice of the moment and feel that will have a justifiable place in the world?
Yeah, I guess I feel the most important thing, you know, when you talk about the takeaway, what's the takeaway from your book? I don't mean to sound negative, because I'm not negative, but you learn the transience of all things, and that is the toughest lesson of all. And once you can cope with that, then you can write what you wish, you can express yourself in a way that is conscious at every moment of that transience, yet refuses to yield to it.
James Atlas, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
James Atlas's new memoir is called My Life in the Middle Ages.